It's Chatter on Books, and if you think this introduction is boring, you try writing the copy. I'm Jamie McIntyre. Here's Tori Clark.
Welcome back to Chatter. Hope everybody is doing well. That's an expression that actually means something these days. Staying healthy. In just a little bit, we're going to be talking to Emily Nemitz, she's a Renaissance woman. She's a writer, she's an editor, she's an illustrator, and she is the author of The Cactus League, which is an absolutely fabulous book about spring training, which is on right now, thank God. And joining tonight, we have Claude doing all the important work, David Aldridge wearing his sporty AU sweatshirt, as ever. Go Eagles. And Mike Crowley, Chatter alum. Welcome back, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be back.
How are things out in Denison land?
Oh, they're good. We're hanging in there. The students we're doing testing every week. They're going to do 2,600 tests next Wednesday. They're going to test every student, faculty, and staff.
Wow. How do they do it? Do they do the group thing where everybody spits and the spit is tested as?
Well, we did that early in the semester. This time they're going to do the nasal swab, and they've enlisted the National Guard to come in. So the governor has sort of given the test to us for free. The state's given the test to us for free. And then they mobilize the National Guard personnel to come in and make sure we've done it. So it's halfway through the semester. So I guess it makes sense. We've only had 6 cases, I think, this semester.
Wow. That's pretty good. And do they test faculty just as regularly?
Yeah. They do a signal test where they just 10% of the population, students and faculty. And so you get an email and you got to go do a test. So they test 200 people every week, and we've only had 6 cases so far. I don't know how. So
that's remarkable. Well, how about West Virginia doing the best job of delivering the vaccinations?
Yeah.
We could tell any number of West Virginia jokes, but God bless them. Okay, I've got a few random things that I want to talk about. And Mike, I want you to talk about that great essay you wrote about playing catch with Annie Dillard.
Okay.
But before that, so everybody remembers our friend Lewis Byard, who is a fabulous guy. He was first on the show talking about Courting Mr. Lincoln, which is a wonderful book. And he's been a panelist a couple times. Great guy. So there was news last week. He wrote, before Courting Mr. Lincoln, he wrote a book called The Pale Blue Eye, which is about murders at West Point, early 1800s, I guess. And the investigation is aided by a young cadet named Edgar Allan Poe. And I haven't read it. I've heard it's fabulous. I haven't read it. But last week, according to Lewis, Christian Bale and director Scott Cooper, who's a pretty big deal, I think he's a pretty big director, are teaming up to make the movie of Pale Blue Eye.
This is fantastic.
So us regulars at Chatter are getting ever closer to our red carpet experience. Because Lewis has heard me say many, many times, if you're on the show and your book gets made into a legit movie, and as we move out of the pandemic, because it'll take him a year or two to make the movie.
Didn't you have Disha on, who wrote The Secret Lives of Church Ladies?
Yes.
That just got picked up by HBO.
Awesome. So and Robert Jones Jr. last week, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
He wouldn't tell us who, but somebody he's in talks with somebody on The Prophets.
We're going to be shunted off to like the yellow carpet. It would
I'm
be the
okay
lesser carpet.
Am I right with that? As long as we can.
Carpet for B and C list celebrities.
As long as we can bring our drinks. So one time, many, many years ago, there was a guy, I can see him. He was the theater movie critic or whatever for the Chicago Trib. And he was in love with my sister, Katie, who's an actress. David is familiar with Katie's work.
Yes.
And trying to endear himself to her, he would invite me to things. And one time he invited me to go to the Emmys with him.
Like, is this Ebert? Sure.
No, not Ebert. Not Ebert. No, this would be like the yellow carpet version of person. So we go out and think of the time difference. And he says, well, we got kind of an early bird special dinner, but we're going to go to this great restaurant. I'll pick you up at your hotel or whatever. Picks me up in the most beautiful blue convertible Rolls Royce you've ever seen in your life.
Wow.
Gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. And it belonged to a friend of his, of course, and said, so off we go. We go to the restaurant and the valet parker comes out and he makes some joke about, be careful with this car because it's not mine. Valet parker laughs. We go into dinner. We come out. There is a gash the size of the Grand Canyon down the side of the guy's Rolls Royce.
Ow, yeah. Ow, ow,
so
ow.
Then, first of all, if you ever get invited, David, you've probably been to the ESPYs?
Once, yes.
Yeah. Which year? Because early years were good.
No, this was 2015. This was just a few years ago.
Yeah. Most award shows are dreadful because they're so long and they're so painful. The Emmys, terrible. So long, so painful, so awful. And this poor guy sat there the whole night rocking, like just, you know, banging his head against the wall, trying to figure out how to tell his friend that he had wrecked his car. So there we go. But wherever Lewis
and he worked, didn't get and he didn't hook up with your sister either.
He never hooked up with her. No. You know, maybe up in heaven now. They're both up in heaven. Okay. So we're very happy with Lewis and we hope he stays in touch with us. Do we dare talk about Dr. Seuss?
Your chateau.
David, what do you think?
It seems to me that this is something from everything that I've read that's being done by the estate of Dr. Seuss. Mm-hmm. They're voluntarily pulling some of these books. This is not because of any significant protests by anyone. And so if they're just being unilaterally cautious, and if you look at some of the, some of the Tintin artists.
Yeah.
Woo, it's not good. So, I have no problem with it whatsoever.
I agree. Mike?
Oh, yeah, I think it's a good move. I mean, I have kids that age, so I don't really want to explain those books to them.
Yeah. And I think about once every 6-8 weeks in the show, seems like some kind of censorship thing comes up. And often it's some wacky parents group is asking their local libraries to take books off the shelves or whatever. This is the estate of Dr. Seuss that runs everything, makes the money. They made these choices themselves. They had the guts to bring it out on Dr. Seuss Day or whatever it was. I think it's completely different.
Yes, but then, this is self-editing.
Yeah, but when I started reading the titles, I thought, well, I never saw that one. And then I went and looked and went, wow, I might pull those off the shelves too. And I realized when it came to Dr. Seuss books, and so Mike, how old are your kids and what's the Dr. Seuss age these days?
Well, they're 4 and 3, so they're into rhyming words. They're always asking, like, does this rhyme? My son likes to say, hey, dad, does this rhyme? Food. I'm like, yeah, it does rhyme, although those are the exact words. So that's his big thing. So he's 3. He just turned 3, and our daughter turns 5. At the end of school, so.
Okay, I was probably 10 before I got to Dr. Seuss. But I realize I am with Dr. Seuss books the way I am about Star Wars, in which I like the original, and then I never like anything else. So I like the Cat in the Hat, which I think was the first big one, right? Cat in the Hat endlessly, day in, day out. Loved it. Go as thing one and thing two, right? Love Dr. Seuss. And then I swear to God, Green Eggs and Ham came along at some point, and I just thought, I'm not into this. I don't care about Green Eggs and Ham. So I saw all these other titles and said, well, I don't really care that they're taking them off the shelves.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
He got turned down. I told you this, I think. He got turned down by like 26 publishing houses. He went to 26 publishing houses and they all said, this is ridiculous. No, we're not. This is stupid. And we're not doing it. And it's dumb. And then the 27th one went, all right, we'll publish it. You imagine?
I did see at the course of all this coverage of it, and it's crazy, somebody criticizing him, not for the, I think racist tint is a safe way to describe some of the early stuff, but the fact that he would make up words so, Mike, they would rhyme.
Right. Yeah.
So tell your kids to be creative. You're a creative writer. They can just make up words.
How could you not like the Grinch, Tori? It's classic.
Yeah. It is a classic. And I love the dog and everything else. But that was not a big deal as a book.
That's true. Back in
the dark ages when I was a child. But yeah, the annual thing. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. We have an email. Hold on. I was supposed to have read this 2 weeks ago and I didn't, but I'll do it with you guys. So to Dave and Mike, this is from Sheila in Charlottesville, which I could not say 3 times fast. A few weeks ago, we're almost into the pandemic for a year. Now we are officially into the pandemic for a year.
Yes.
If you were going to write a short story about one aspect of the pandemic, what would it be? Mike, you go first.
Oh, God. Well, I've been thinking about this a lot, I guess, as a writer. So
I'll let you think for a second. I'll describe. People should know that Mike's wearing a very professorial sweater, a nice little cardigan.
It's true. It's true. I don't know. I think I'd probably write a short story. I'm pretty realistic, naturalistic writer. So it'd probably be every conversation you have is, it could be anything, going to the grocery store, but it's really about some sort of existential despair. Cause that's really all I feel for the last 6 months. You know, it's all pretty rough. So I don't have like a major plot line, but I feel like every conversation we have these days about everything that the subtext is this ever going to be over?
Yeah. I heard, I'm giving David time to think about this. I listened to, and I wisely stayed out of a conversation, young couple, first baby, 9 months old. So she's a pandemic baby. And the baby, not surprisingly, loves phones. phones are always around, loves looking at the phones, the screen lights up and this and that. And it was a discussion about the interaction that comes about as a result of the phone with the baby's grandparents, with the baby's cousins, that she doesn't really understand the cousins and these kinds of things. And one parent is advocating that for the interaction with other people, this is good, using these devices and having the devices around. And the other one was saying, absolutely no way, no how. And we're going to have the end of the pandemic at some point, and the kid has to start rolling around with other kids in real life. But that was interesting. Literally, the only people who have held this baby are the parents.
Wow.
The only ones, yeah. So, David, what would you write about? It's a short story, honey.
I'd write about flight attendants. I wonder if they're happy that the planes are not empty, or the planes are relatively empty, or if they miss the obnoxious people full flights.
Asking where their peanuts are.
Exactly. You know, yeah. I just wonder, because it's a totally thankless job, and it's miserable, and they don't get paid what they used to be and what they used to get paid. And the unions have been decimated and just given all their pensions away. And I just wonder, like, but is it at least less stressful, or is it more stressful because you know, inevitably you're going to have some rando that doesn't want to put a mask on. I just wonder what it's like for them, what this has been like being on emptier planes.
Yeah. A few months ago, I sat next to outdoors to a woman who sat at an outdoor brewery, as a matter of fact, who's a Southwest flight attendant.
Mm-hmm.
And we, of course, were asking her about it. And she, this was probably several months ago, so she wasn't quite as worried about the industry, and 6 months ago, we thought things might come back. Anyway, she said that it was very strange, said that the planes were cleaner than ever because they were sanitizing everything all the time. They fixed or improved the circulation systems. They weren't serving food and booze and things like that. So that limited all that kind of stuff. And she says, but the best thing is the bathrooms. And I said, what do you mean? And she says, well, think about where the galleys are, where the flight attendants hang out at the front and the back of the planes. They're always right next to the lavatories. And she said, you know, for years and years and years, you're there getting drinks ready for somebody, or, you know, David Aldridge in 3B is bitching because he doesn't have a second bag of peanuts.
Is it a window? Because I always have a window.
Oh, no, I want an aisle seat. Don't you want to be able to run?
No. I can't do aisle seats. It's weird. I'm weird, Tori. I got to have a window. Sorry.
Well, we could travel together, because also I want to be able to run. But she said, and this is horrifying when you think about it, she says, you hear, when you're in the galley and you're in flight attendant, you hear everything.
Oh, sure.
And you hear that, as she said, pre-pandemic, the overwhelming majority of people, including the pilots, don't wash their hands.
Oh,
and she said the biggest difference, I guess that's how we got in this conversation, what's the biggest change? She said the biggest difference was everybody washes their hands now.
I can't believe that.
Isn't that disgusting?
It's disgusting. I always wash my hands.
Even pre-pandemic, I would wash my hands in there and then try to open the little door.
Yes. you do this. You take your sleeve and you open your door like that. And so you have to expose your hand. I wash my hands all the time.
Flight attendants are happy. I was on a flight when I was traveling around for my book 2 years ago. And it was only me. I walked onto the plane. I was like, I think I'm late for my flight. And they're like, what's your name? And they told me, like, come on in. They opened the door. The gate door was already closed. And I thought, oh, gosh. And I rushed down. I rushed down the jetway. And I walk into the plane. It was completely empty. And I thought, I'm going to die on this flight.
Of course. Of course it's the flight you're going to die.
And so there was me and one other woman. And these two flight attendants were as happy as they could be. They're like, here, you guys are in first class now. Here's a free drink. Take another free drink. Take this. They're like, we're going to get in late. Take some more food. They just, they were just like grandmothers. Like, here, take off.
Take it all.
Nice.
Love it.
Okay. So Mike and I were trading emails or texts or something the other day, and he sent something to me, which I had not read before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called The Time I Played Catch with Annie Dillard, Mike.
I called it spring training, but the people at Lit Hub in the clickbaity way changed it to which they were right. That's a better title, I guess, to get people to click on it. So, mm-hmm.
So tell us about it, and it'll be a great intro to our baseball story.
Yeah. So for years, I went to graduate school at Florida State, and one of my mentors is the writer Lee Smith from Virginia. Uh-huh. And when I got in to Florida State, she says, you have to come to spring training with us next year. So I drove down from Tallahassee to Tarpon Springs, and I get there to see Lee and her husband Hal Crowther. And then there's this woman there, and she introduces herself. She goes, hi, I'm Annie. And it took me a minute to realize that that was Annie Dillard. Because her and Lee had gone to college together at Hollins College in Virginia. And then her husband is Robert Richardson, who wrote very prominent biographies of Emerson and Thoreau and William James. And then Roy Blunt Jr. was there.
Oh, sure. Great.
It was just like, it was like all the benefits of going to a writer's conference without any of the BS, because we didn't have to talk about writing. We just talked about baseball the whole time. So then one day I was, one day Hal and another friend of ours who was a professor at North Carolina was, they were playing catch, and Annie asked if she could try. And so Annie and I went off and played catch, and she kept short hopping me. And I had to go, and I had to also, I only had a left-hander's glove, and I'm not a lefty. So I had like, I was kind of doing like the Jim Abbott thing, changing around. But it felt like in the middle of it, it just felt like being in one of her essays where she was, because that was one of her great prides as a young woman, was that she'd been very athletic. And so it was
I didn't know that.
Every throw she felt like she was, it felt like she was trying to get back to some place that she had been, you know? Mm-hmm. And she, I kept chasing this ball. I mean, I was sweating. I mean, she probably only got like three or four to me, but it was Annie. So I just kept chasing him and chasing him and chasing him. And she was just really great. And then I don't remember if it's in the essay or not, but I remember later we went to dinner and she was bragging to this waitress while she smoked a cigarette. She asked me to go out with her, and she was bragging to the waitress about all the writers at the table without mentioning who she was. So I felt compelled to tell the woman who she was. And as I started to say, I said, well, I was like, you know, this woman here. And Annie started stepping on my foot, and she's like, shut up.
Pulitzer Prize winner. Did you get it out?
I was like, have you heard of the Pulitzer Prize? She's like, oh, sure. And I was like, right here, she's a winner. And she was very, you know, she was very humble about it, and, you know, couldn't have cared less. But she was just really sweet to me. She gave great advice, and she was really open and warm. And then I remember I sat on that story for a long time, and then I finally decided to write the essay, and I sent it to her, and she was really, it was like an education the way she wrote back. She's like, you use this adverb incorrectly, and people always say this, and they mean this. And she's like, it's fine. Go ahead, publish it. Good luck. if you get to know Annie, that's how she is. There's a really sweet, gruff generosity about her. And she's a big soul. I mean, she's a great lady. So
I think you writers are very generous with one another. I don't know, David, your cohorts, you know, in the sports journalism world, I know you guys help each other out in some ways, but there just seems to be a real support system and a real network and an eagerness to help one another.
Yes. For the most part, I would say that's true. I mean, there's some people that nobody cares particularly much about, but for the most part, yeah, we try to help each other out. And we, you know, the people in our side of the street, like Gary Smith and people like that, that just were and are just prolific, insanely talented writers that make you feel just so stupid every time you read one of their long forms. He would write a lot of the back of the book stuff in Sports Illustrated, these 12,000 word stories and features on people that are just so much better than anything you'd ever write in your life. It makes you at once you have despair and you have this incredible gratitude that you got to read something this good.
Yeah.
You know, it's just,
true. When I was a kid, I didn't go to school, but I would read Sports Illustrated. I would read Time. I'd read Newsweek. I'd read the New Republic. I'd read the New Yorker. And stupid as I was, I could read some of that stuff and go, oh my gosh, these people actually know how to use words.
Yeah.
Right. Amazing. Okay. Emily Nemens, you ready to join us?
I am. I was thinking, I've heard about that Grapefruit League group of writers. I saw Mary Flynn last February at the start of my book tour, the editor at BCU editor and writer. And she goes down as well.
Yeah. Mary's a big part of the group. She's one of the originals. I mean, at any given year, there'll be some, like, I remember one year we were watching the Ken Burns Prohibition special. My wife and I were watching, and then William Lechtenberg came on, who's like one of the most prominent FDR scholars of all time. I was like, I know that guy, because he goes every year. He's in his 90s. He keeps book. He keeps book for every game. I mean, it's just a
beautiful
roster of it. It was kind of like, for a really young person, it was like, this is the life I want, the life of the mind, and then this too.
Right.
Every spring. It was a great education.
Nice. Very nice. Well, Emily Nemens, thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to talk a little bit about you, then a lot about your book, The Cactus League. That's great. So I'm probably going to miss a couple of places you've lived, but Seattle, studying studio art at Brown, Louisiana State, editor of the Paris Review. You're an illustrator, which I find absolutely fascinating. I want to talk about. But where did the writing and the art genes come from?
I don't know. Very generous parents who sort of let me do what I wanted. Growing up, I was actually probably most serious about the baritone saxophone.
Really?
Yeah, I played baritone sax for years and years, but I didn't want to be a studio musician. And
why not?
Because I was playing with some profound musicians, just like people who are now, you know, major jazz musicians, and I got a little bit of an inferiority complex. So I love listening, I love learning with them, I love playing with them. But you know, when it came time to pick a college, I thought, you know, maybe a liberal arts degree is the way to go. So I spread it out a little bit. And you know, I always wanted to write, but in that sort of egoful way of a teenager, I thought, oh, I'll read the books, I'll figure it out on my own. What I don't know how to do is, you know, study art history. I need help learning how to paint. Like, I need instruction. I don't need instruction in books. Of course, I did need instruction in books, and that's why I went back for grad school, you know, later. But yeah, I was just sort of omnivorous and curious, and some things I wanted to write and some things I wanted to draw, and sometimes I wanted to toot on a saxophone.
It's really, we have a lot of authors on the show, obviously, and they have a lot of different backgrounds, or a lot of different hobbies and things like that. We've never had this before. And it's almost like being ambidextrous.
The writing. Well, I was for a little while. One place you didn't mention, I lived in Madrid and was studying studio art in Spain, which was great because my Spanish was horrible. Fabulous. I couldn't conjugate verbs. I spoke like a six-year-old for about 7 years of studying Spanish. But I was taking studio art classes there, including like really classical anatomy. We did you know, figure drawing for 20-hour poses, wild stuff like that. But I did another course where we had to just draw with both hands. So for like 9 glorious months and I don't know, 2004, I was fairly ambidextrous.
Did you ever think that was going to be, that art was going to be your career?
No, maybe a little. You know, I was, my first two jobs, one was at the Smithsonian's Archives of American Art, and the next one was at the Metropolitan Museum, and I was editing in both of those places. So and I was pretty certain I was going to figure out how to, you know, find intersections or shove both into a jar or do something where I got to touch both.
So we're going to slowly, artfully segue to the book, The Cactus League, which I just loved. And I know everybody who's going to play all the parts in the movie. You're very intellectual. You have this great education, this great training, but you went to spring training a lot. Where does that come from? Where does the love for spring training and watching?
I grew up in Seattle in the 80s, which is to say watching Ken Griffey Jr. in the Kingdom. And
David can relate.
I hated the Kingdom, but I like Safeco. It's nice stadium.
Yeah, I mean, I hated the Kingdom, except that, you know, it's where I fell in love with baseball. And by contrast, going to spring training, where it was sunny and bright and warm, and baseball was outside and there was grass and you were close to the players, like all of that was just magical. And so my dad, who grew up walking distance from Yankee Stadium, you know, moved to Seattle right about when the Mariners started. So he was like, well, this is what we've got.
Yeah.
And we didn't go every year, but, you know, starting when I was 11 or 12, we'd go every few seasons. And then when I was on the East Coast and he was still out West, we'd meet down there, which, you know, we could both get direct flights to Phoenix for not a lot.
Nice.
And, it's not like at 12, I had a reporter's notebook out and was like, I'm going to write about spring training, but going there and building these rituals and, you know, falling in love with the place and watching it change, because Phoenix
has
changed a lot since, you know, 95.
Yeah. No, I used to work for John McCain. I spent a lot of time in Arizona. When I first worked for him, mid 80s, early 80s, Phoenix was maybe 1 million people. Mm-hmm. And you could drive up and down a few streets in 5 minutes and you were done with downtown Phoenix. And then you got to Scottsdale, which had its fancy parts, but also was still pretty quickly you get into the mountains. And now I don't know what Phoenix has, 3 or 4 million people. It's huge. That whole metropolitan area is absolutely huge. But spring training, the best time of year to be in Arizona is that time of year, spring training. Yeah. It's beautiful. It's warm. The pollution in the valley hasn't kicked in. David, did you ever go out there? Did you ever go to spring training out there? Or do you do the Grapefruit League in Florida?
Grapefruit. And not that much, but the last few years with the Nats, I've been down there a few times. So
yeah.
I can understand the romanticization of it. It is, you know, it's wonderful. You get to watch baseball every afternoon and you're done at two and you still can go out to, you know, do whatever you want. So it's great. I get it.
Time differences can be very good things. Okay. So Emily, talking specifically about the book, and Mike and David, you know, interrupt, jump in. This is a character-driven book, The Cactus League, which I love because I read it and I listened to it in my car driving to Gulfport, which was fabulous to listen to it. And I think about what these people look like to me. But one of the things that these people literally bump into each other, literally, figuratively, they bump into each other throughout the book. How much did you draw from people you knew from your years of watching spring training? Because there are some classic people, the players, the coaches, the hangers-on, the girlfriends, those kinds of people. How much did you draw from people you actually knew, and how did you keep everybody straight, and how did you decide how they would bump into one another?
What was revision.
What's that?
Revision. I mean, at one point I had a 40-man roster and wives and girlfriends for, you know, however many people who wanted them, you know, not some were definitely, you know, flying solo by choice, but I had a really elaborate system and network of players and coaches and hangers-on and concession workers and bartenders and, you know, golf caddies and all of it, because I wanted to really lean into the idea that people do run into each other at stadiums. It's, you know, a focal point. It's crowded. I mean, not this year.
David and I meet on the concourse at the Cap One Arena during a hockey game. Mm-hmm. Then we're immediately swarmed by David Aldridge fans, but that's a whole other story.
So I wanted to just, you know, lean into that and exploit the idea of people running into each other and walking past one another, being aware of one another's presence. And maybe not aware sometimes, right? But everyone's focused on the same thing, which is the start of the season, sort of the potential of this spring season and what happens beyond it, of Jason Goodyear, who's their generational player and the club's biggest investment. So, you know, I didn't dream that up from the very beginning. To start were, you know, individual characters who are sort of the focal points of each chapter and creating really empathetic, compelling people who, you know, are built out of, you know, some real life people, some movie characters, some people from literature, characters from literature. But I feel like baseball literature and baseball storytelling so often is a bit ham-fisted and relies on archetypes more than it needs to. And so I wanted to take some of those smaller expectations and kind of explode and explore them a bit, you know, give the baseball Annies a bit more dimensionality and personality than
Mike Crowley is nodding his head yes and laughing. Mike?
I just love the book so much because I was thinking as you were talking, Emily, I think you and I might have traded some emails over this, but Was it hard to leave some of these characters behind because you only each one inning? But I did like how you turned all those archetypes on their head. I thought that was a really fantastic part of the book. But there were some of the characters I missed more than others, as you would expect in a novel. And I was curious what that was like for you as you were writing it. Was it hard to like just kind of leave their stories behind and only let them have sort of collision points for the remainder of the book?
Yeah, I mean, I already wrote my pandemic story, which was, you know, somebody at the Chronicles of Now asked me, you know, to write a baseball pandemic story. And I was like, I know exactly how Jimmy, the catcher, would handle this, you know, crazy year. And it took like, I don't know, an afternoon to write and imagine what Jimmy would be doing 9 years later. Like, his knees are shot, he's stuck in, sequestered in a hotel trying to, you know, make the Arizona plan work, which of course didn't happen. But, you know, there was a moment last spring where there was going to be a bubble in the Phoenix Metro. So I do miss them. I think about them a lot, but you know, part of my writing process, as I said, is revision. And I really wanted it to be a good reading experience, which involves momentum, which involves concision, which involves taking away details, really building these robust worlds and backstories, but not putting more of that on the page than you absolutely need. I cut 25,000 words out of the last draft.
I was just going to ask you that. I think I heard that in an interview you did. 25,000 words?
Yeah. That's yeah. It's like 85,000 now. So, you know, there were a few scenes, like the chapter 5 with the Tommy John had like a whole subplot that got taken away. But mostly it was like paragraph excision or line level excision.
Wow.
It was, I don't know. I just like got, I got it in my head that's what I needed to do. And like 4 months later, I looked up.
What's it called? We got to kill the children. We have to kill the small children. So Ken Follett, who writes these 9 million long page books, uses spreadsheets. He has so many characters, and he described, David, you're on that show, he described spreadsheets by which he keeps track of all the characters and what they've done and with whom they've interacted. Rebecca Sachs, a few weeks ago, and I really encourage people to look this up online because the visual is spectacular, puts clothesline around, she wrote City of 1,000 Gates, and she put clothesline around all the walls in her apartment. And then I think, David, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think she almost started with words. She would start with words on a piece of paper and put it up on the clothesline. And then she would look to see how those words related to other words. And then it grew to sentences and paragraphs and people and characters. And it was
almost atomic level writing. Yes.
Atomic level. And then she had to start taking stuff down. But how do you keep track of all your characters? And boy,
That sounds beautiful. That sounds beautiful and organized.
It was a little scary. Rebecca will never listen to the show again because she was horrified by it. But no, it was a little horrifying.
I just had a lot of notes. I just had like crazy lady handwritten notes.
Handwritten?
Like, in notebooks, like on the back of old drafts. You know, I wasn't as organized as I would have liked to, particularly having moved several times between now and then. I think there's like a shoebox full of, you know, that 40-man roster somewhere.
Yeah.
Maybe in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, maybe under my bed in New York City. I really don't know. You know, David, I do think like an uncanny thing for me is that I have a pretty good visual memory, which like makes sense. So I had, you know, I can even like remember when I'm reading a book, like, oh, this was sort of in the middle of the book on the upper right hand.
Wow.
Spread, you know, it was near these kinds of terms. So like when I was doing sort of the last tying together and making sure people were walking by each other at the right velocity,
right?
And really fine tuning those interactions. It was just like a lot of search and replace.
Wow. Okay. The essence of spring training to me is optimism. It's like, you know, first thing in the morning, this day could be a really good day. Yeah, by 4 PM, shot, but right. But spring training, and I've been to a lot of it out there, it's about optimism. And even the aging player thinks, you know, maybe I got another season, that kind of thing. Is that important to you as a writer, as a person?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think I wrote a kind of bleak book, but you know, I don't think I'm spoiling it to say it ends on a note of optimism. You know, everyone does wake up and think that this is going to be their morning, this is going to be their year. And for most of them, it's not, it doesn't go that well. But,
I kept thinking about when I'm
reading the door open, you know, I wanted the season to still have that possibility of redemption.
Yeah. Seriously, David, I kept thinking about you as I was reading this book and listening to it, because there are some people at the end of their careers and your heart's breaking for them and you want them to make it another, right?
Sometimes.
Depends on how big a bleep they've been.
Exactly.
Do you ever treat any of them a little more kindly than you do others?
Yes, on the way out, because you know how hard it is, how incredibly hard it is to be a professional anything really, but you know, the business that I've chosen, a professional athlete, it's incredibly hard.
Yeah.
And they have to sacrifice more and more and more as they get older just to be able to compete. And they always say the same thing when they retire. It wasn't the playing, it was the preparation that got them out. They just couldn't do what you have to do to prepare for a game, a season. And so sure, most people that are going out, you don't want to be, you know, unkind to them. Because you know how hard it is, or at least you have an idea of how hard it is. You don't know how hard it is, but you have an idea.
How often do you think they hang on too long?
All the time.
Yeah.
All of them hang on too long.
Tom Brady being in that special.
There's very few Jim Browns in sports. He retired at 29. There's very few of him.
Okay. Emily, back to you. Again, I want to be very careful not to give things away. I really encourage people to read The Cactus League. There are some cringeworthy scenes in the book. And when I read them, I kind of went, oh, and then when I listened to it, it was almost worse. The swimming pool is one for me. Jason Goodyear and the lamps at the Frank Lloyd Wright house. I was like, oh. Were those hard to write, fun to write, horrifying to write? What was it like from your perspective?
They were fun, I think. You know, I'm a pretty empathetic, I'd like to believe, person who's, you know, pretty protective of friends and colleagues and strangers. And so to give myself, it wasn't easy, but to give myself the license to write difficult situations, write people behaving badly and treating each other in not great ways, treating, you know, national historic landmarks in not great ways. Was a challenge, but it was fun.
Great scenes. But I found myself when I was reading the book going, I need to get through this. And then I'm in my car driving to south to Gulfport, Mississippi. And I swear to God, I was hitting the fast forward a couple of times going, I don't need to say more. Okay. Talk about Cut Day. Mm-hmm. Talk about Cut Day. And I remember hearing this when I used to go to spring training sometimes, but talk about Cut Day. David and Mike, I'm sure, know about it, but explain what Cut Day is. And how everyone starts to dread Thursdays, because Thursday is the day before.
So I guess to back up, you know, most baseball narratives are about the bottom of the ninth inning or the World Series, or, you know, drama is at the end of the season. And I wanted to think about a world in which games didn't count, where winning didn't count, and where else is the drama? And it's in Cut Day. It's in Thursdays, which is, you know, the day during most spring trainings, maybe not this one because minor league camps aren't starting until much later, right? But but usually they do a sweep and kick guys out every Thursday, and you're reassigned to a minor league camp or you're just told to go home entirely. And it's a procedural thing on one level, but it's also, you know, sort of a death knell for some of these guys. And I think for a lot, for the starters, for some of the characters in the book, it was just another Thursday, and it just meant they had more elbow room in the locker room. But for other guys, they were, you know, they knew it was coming, and really just felt like they had numbered days. And I think that's enough drama for a book. And I just hadn't seen that narrative or read about that sort of emotion of really playing with borrowed time and what the toll of knowing that you would have to say goodbye to this thing that you've, you know, been working on since you were four.
And you might have been a star in grade school and high school and even college. And it's just, you just didn't make it. Yeah.
Right. And even if you'll have another chance the following season, I mean, one of the characters is, someone that was drafted right out of high school, which is an improbable thing, but happens every year. And he's woefully underprepared and trying his hardest and just really sucks. And he'll still be a great player. He'll still do really well, but this is just an awful year.
Yeah. David. So, okay. That character, again, I thought of David so much during this. This kid was the star. Grades, every, you know, T-ball, grade school, high school, the star, and always the one everyone turned to, all the one everybody says is going to change the world. And he gets to this and he's not the star. And worse than that, he just sucks, as Emily said. Have you seen that? I mean, we probably don't spend time writing about them.
Oh, sure. All the time. Oh, sure. No, and it's very humbling. You have to think about it. I mean, what I always think about is that on any given team in any given sports league, the guy or the woman who does not play at all on their team, they're the last person that gets into a game, if they get into a game at all. When they were in high school or college, they were the best player in their entire state, probably, or in their entire conference. These are all accomplished people. These are like great players, you know, and they get to the pros where you are playing with immortals and Hall of Famers, and you can't, you're not better than them. And it's very humbling to a lot of people. And that's why it's very difficult to become what are known as role players. You know, I'll just do this instead of playing all the time. I just play a little bit now and I have to be a good teammate. Those are totally different and new skill sets that these people have to learn very quickly or they don't make it.
And I bet most of them don't make it. That's most too hard a transition. My sister Katie, she of the, I now remember the guy's name. His name was Mike Killian.
Okay.
Mike Killian, thank you. I knew it would come to me. She dumped the greatest guy in the world, Lewis Black, to marry this horrible person, Michael McLaughlin. Michael McLaughlin from State College, PA, or something like that, was a spectacular high school football player.
Yeah.
And he might have even made, I don't know if he made it, he might have gotten hurt before he was going to go be the quarterback for Penn State or whatever. But he got hurt, so his football career did not continue. And despite getting into Oxford years later, by the way, he never made it through his PhD. He never got over that. He never got over that he wasn't the most important guy in the room every single time, that he wasn't the one everyone looked up to, that everybody wrote about. It was the driving influence in his life was no longer being.
Failure rate is massive. It's massive. And baseball is all about failure. That's the whole point of the sport. So it's really hard to stick with baseball. It's very hard.
Very labor intensive.
I like that character, Emily, so much, the rookie who's not panning out because – you know, I, one of the things, like I did some minor league reporting and it's just such a, it just screws with your mind so much to, I've always been the best person ever. And I thought that was one of the great things you did with him, was because it's not really that his skills aren't up to snuff. I mean, there's that element, but it's really like, if your head's not in the right space, you can't perform. I talked to Shelly Duncan, who played for the Yankees for a number of years. And he said, Dave Duncan's son. And he said, he goes, are you a great hitter because you're confident, or are you confident because you're a great hitter? He goes, that's what I'd struggle with every single day.
Wow.
And I've always thought about that, especially with baseball players, because as David says, right, you fail 7 times and you're a Hall of Famer out of 10, right? Like, it's a crazy thing to think about. And I thought that character was so well done. And so, and he was like such a sweet kid. You know, I like that about him. He's like such a kind of a sweet, dumb kid, which I liked about him very much too.
Who were your, there are so many different characters in this book, Emily, the Cactus League. Did you have favorites of the ones you saved that you did cut in the 25,000 words you cut? Do you have favorites?
Oh, I mean, I think the sort of the star of every chapter, which is a cheat, I realize, because that gives me 9, but.
It's not a cheat. It's a great, effect.
Yeah, I mean, I love Tammy. I love Herb. I don't know. I watched a lot of reality TV around sports, wives and girlfriends. And, you know, they were not wonderful to one another, but I also felt like this deep empathy for, you know, people who are supporting professional athletes who get, you know, moved around all the time, who are without their partners for often, you know, half the year, and who need to make friends and find affinities where they can. You know, their constraint might not be a financial one, but it's still a really challenging and lonely situation. So even in some of the more materialistic characters, I still worry about Melissa Moyers.
Yeah, exactly. I kept saying to myself, I hope there's a sequel to this, because I'm worried about some of these people. I want to know what happens. Okay, so you are an illustrator and an artist, New Yorker. You did these great watercolor portraits of women in Congress, right? The 112th, 113th Congress. As you were writing and developing these characters on paper, did you think of them visually? Do you have visual images? Because I think, David, check me on this. I think Ken Follett told us that as many successful books as he has, when he's writing the books, he has a distinct image in his mind of what that person looks like.
Yes.
Physical characteristics. And then when people turn them into movies, they always screw it up. But because you're ambidextrous with your visual and your writing, do you have clear pictures in your mind of what they look like?
Yeah, pretty clear pictures. I was thinking more about, in terms of visualizing the cactus, like I was thinking more about the architecture and the layout of Scottsdale and Phoenix. You know, the stadium was built sort of on the last plot of developable land in this eastern suburb of Phoenix. You know, the next piece of land is a mountain. So I was really thinking about, in sort of the visual energy for me, was thinking about how this city had grown up and grown together and sort of hit its limit in terms of expansion and the possibility there. So there are plenty of schematics, but more about city planning.
Interesting. Okay, so let me get you out with this. Let me check the time. Yeah, let me get you out with this, because I'm just obsessed with this idea of you being an artist and a writer all at the same time. So you studied a ton of art history, you know everything there is to know about art. If you're writing, let's say in particular, the Cactus League was a painting, what kind of painting would it be? This is like, what kind of tree would you be question, but what kind of painting or what school would your writing be in?
Oh, that's a great question. I really don't know, but you know, this last weekend I went masked to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which was wonderful. And I saw the Goya exhibition where, you know, he did these suites of portfolios of prints that were sort of vignettes that all spoke to one another and thematically built and resonated. So, you know, there's a star of each print, a message in each image, but compounding and together, they really painted the portrait of this society in which he lived and with which he loved, but, you know, also saw faults. So Goya's.
Nice. Print. I like that a lot. Okay. This is awesome. The book is The Cactus League. Everyone should buy it at their favorite local independent bookstore. Emily, what's next?
More writing. I have about 30,000 words of the next book. I hope I can stick the landing. I mean, there's a lot more between the landing and now, but.
Can you give us a hint at where, what direction you're going with your next work?
There's more art in it.
Excellent.
You know, I loved writing about baseball, and I could write about baseball all the time, forever. I got to write about the Mariners for the Baseball Prospectus this spring, and that was so fun. But I wanted to, you know, use another muscle and write in, you know, a slightly different orbit. And it's about contemporary art.
Excellent. Well, we hope you come back. We'll hope you come back. This is awesome. I hope by the time that one's done, you'll be able to actually go to places and do real book signings and everything else. Although I have to say, I was watching a bunch of interviews with Emily to get ready for this. And it still cracks me up when the classic bookstores, I won't name them. Oh, politics and prose. The people who host them, first of all, they always talk about themselves. It's 5-10 minutes of the person hosting the author. And it's like all anybody wants to see or hear from is the author. And the person hosting it always talks about themselves for 5 or 10 minutes. And they always talk about what was meaningful to them as a child. And then they make the poor author read for 10 minutes. It's like, come on. I mean, maybe you read the book and you could talk about what's in it. It's driving me crazy. Okay, I've got a little housekeeping and then we have a deserted island. Emily, I don't give the authors homework, but you can just jump in on this. So here's the housekeeping. Download us, follow us. Somebody wrote a really nice review lately on Apple. Thank you very much. Only write reviews if you love us. Yeah, they're worth reading. Someday I'll do a few readings of them because they're really nice and well-written and you can tell the people are clearly not doing it just to be nice to us because they actually have detail to them. So they're worth checking out. We are back next week with Olga Grushin, who is the author of The Charmed Wife. And some folks may remember we had Jess Walters on the show a while ago, Jess Walters of The Cold Millions and Beautiful Ruins. He did one of the blurbs for The Charmed Wife. It's an awesome blurb. In The Charmed Wife, Olga Grushin turns the fairy tale romance on its head and then just keeps turning it playfully, subversively, brilliantly. A feat of fierce imagination. He's a good writer. He's a very good writer. Okay, Deserted Island. March is Women's History Month. Name a favorite book about a famous female in history, or if you couldn't think of a book about a famous female in history, what should be written. David?
I really liked Carl Bernstein's bio of Hillary Clinton. I thought it was the only book really? That I've ever read about Hillary Clinton that actually was about Hillary Clinton. And it wasn't like a sanitized version of her as she would write, you know?
Wow.
It was the actual person who I thought was an incredibly interesting person.
I didn't even know he's written a book about her.
Oh yeah. It's called A Woman in Charge. It was came out in, I want to say it was 2016, but maybe it was before 2008. Huh. It was tied to one of the presidential runs.
Right.
And it was really well done. I mean, he talked to a lot of people. It was about a lot of things about her, but the two books that she's written about herself, I just thought were just not good.
The political memoirs seldom are.
Yeah. They just weren't real, and they weren't, you know, like if you're going to write a book and you don't tell us what you really wanted to do to your husband after that, what's the point of the book?
Like Michelle,
seriously, like
Michelle,
they want to buy the book to read that.
Right. You know? As Michelle Obama did. I continue to say, I do check the bestseller list that, and her book stays up there becoming, it is so worth reading.
Yeah.
And you don't have to have an ounce of interest in politics, an ounce of interest in, or even an ounce of interest in Barack Obama.
Right.
It's just such an interesting personal anthropological study of a person and a marriage, and her honesty in it was stunning.
Yeah.
Okay. Mike Crowley, I should get a nickel every time she sells a copy of that book.
You are standing.
Yeah. And I'm consistent. Mike?
I was just going to put a plug in for my friend and former teacher, Richard Bausch's book about Mary Kingsley, Hello to the Cannibals. She was an explorer in the 18th century, and it's interesting story that intersects with a contemporary story of a young woman. And so that was the one that I had. So she's a little, I think she's kind of a little known as
nice.
Be wrong though, but that's what I was.
Nice. Talking. I always find myself flacking people and books that have been on the show, which is fine. Margaret Lee Shetterly and Hidden Figures. And the more you, the women, the black mathematicians at NASA during the space race, great book, great story, truly unknown, untold story. And the more every once in a while they name a building after one of those wilderness. So you read another story and it's just stunning what they did. And it wasn't just that they happened to be black women who found a way to be successful. They did incredibly important work. So I just have such an appreciation for Margaret Lee Shetterly writing that book. Emily, do you have one? Now, Emily's going to be very high-minded and intellectual.
Yeah.
I do. I just encountered a book about Lucita Hurtado, who died last year, right before her 100th birthday. She was an artist and had, for years and years, sort of played second fiddle to a series of more famous husbands and raised a family, but just had this kind of private but really compelling, really ambitious evolving art practice all the way through it. And she really only started getting attention in her 90s. And
also there's hope. David, Mike,
there you go.
The book, it's just this beautifully assembled sort of oral autobiography, a series of interviews interspersed with her work, interspersed with family photos. It's a beautiful document. It was a great object as well, just a really inspiring story.
That's a lovely one, and it classes us up, so thank you. Okay, everybody. Claude, thank you for doing all the important work, my friend. David, Mike, great to see you again. Stay well. When is Mark Stern on the Denison?
Wednesday. I'll send you the link. You can jump in.
We've got to heckle him.
That is appointment television.
We have got to heckle.
Emily, stay safe. Good luck with all the new work, okay? And we do hope you come back. And everybody, continue to wash your hands, wear masks, be socially distant. And we'll see you next week. Thanks, guys.